members made some assumptions about the disk partitioning program that partitioned the disk. There are a couple of disk partitioning programs. Windows and Linux use a thing called FDisk. There are some newer ones, but they work like FDisk, so we'll just consider them FDisk. One of the characteristics of FDisk is that cylinder 0 doesn't have anything in it but the master boot record in the partition when it's partitioned. All primary partitions start on a track boundary, or actually a cylinder boundary. So the first cylinder is essentially empty when you partition with FDisk. FreeBSD and some others can partition anywhere. So in FreeBSD, I can partition an LBA1, the sector right after the master boot sector can be the start of a partition if I use the FreeBSD partitioning system. If I use the FreeBSD positioning system, don't try to put Linux on that. At least don't try to put Grub on it, or Lilo, or System Commander, because it ain't going to work. Windows ain't going to work either. None of those are going to be usable on a disk that's partitioned that way. Because the assumption that loaders make is that it was partitioned with FDisk. And we'll see what they do here. Let's look at some of the first stage booting. DOS Windows first stage boot loads sector 0, which is the master boot record, or runs sector 0, and that sector 0 first stage boot boots the first sector of the first track of the primary partition that's marked as active. You've probably seen that in the FDisk. You can mark one partition as active. The Windows DOS bootloader searches the partition table, finds the active partition, and reads sector zero, the first sector of that, and that is the second stage boot. So it has a physical position. It's sector 1 of a cylinder, of the first head of the cylinder. FreeBSD stage 1 boot program is slightly different. It uses the partition table, but it offers you the choice of which one by hitting a function key, which is kind of nice, actually. I use this with it. You don't have to have FreeBSD. You know, I loaded VXWorks and DOS, and Linux. DOS and Linux. I loaded DOS and Linux with the FreeBSD primary bootloader. That's the MBR, the first stage. And you just hit a key. And if you don't hit a key after 5 seconds, it simply boots whatever last you used. So this is good old-fashioned self-modifying code. Because what it actually does is, if you hit a function key to pick a sector, it goes in and rewrites the master boot record code so that it knows what to boot the next time if you don't hit a key. Mm-hmm. It physically modifies its code. Mm. Everybody loves self-modifying code, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, actually we do.
Actually, we do. But it's kind of neat. And this is, it's available. Mm-hmm. Found it on the web and picked it up and used it. VXWorks has its own first stage bootloader. And it has a very simple approach. It loads the first sector of the next track. So, it doesn't care it doesn't even have a partition table. It doesn't care about the partition table. It ignores the partition table. It just goes to the next track and reads the first sector, and that's its second stage boot. Now, if I'm using Lilo, Grub, or System Commander, the first stage boot actually boots the second stage, sort of. This is sort of a multi-stage boot. The second stage is stored on Sector 2 of Track 0. So it's stored right after, in the sector right after the master boot record. That's why you can't have a partition starting there. Because Lilo, Grub, System Commander, all of those programs use that, depend on FDISC having left that first sector, first cylinder free. Because that's where they put themselves. They put themselves in that first sector. In Lilo, in particular, the second sector that's loaded by the primary bootloader then extends itself up by up to 23 more sectors to a full Lilo loader. So it's debatable whether Lilo is, whether this is a second stage in a loader or a loader by itself. Hard to tell. Yeah.
That's why I roughly call stage 1.5.
Stage 1.5 is different. Stage 1.5, Grub has, I don't know if we have it on here, yeah. Grub is like Lilo, except it understands more file systems, and that 1.5 station is where it loads the drivers for the other file systems. That's what the 1.5 is. It's specifically in between, it's part of this, it loads all that stuff, but it also loads this. And as best I can tell, Grub does not, the second stage is in the cylinder zero.
Yes.
But the actual data that Grub uses is off in another partition.
It actually does
understand file systems after the 1.5, which loads up some extra drivers. It can go and read those various file systems.
Generally, it's about an 8K stub that's in there, and the size is dependent on the file system it's intended to read / boot on. So if you go into the / boot / grub, you'll see a bunch of different file systems .grub loaded. Or 1-4-5.
Yep.
And basically, whatever file system / boot / grub is on is a file system that will start at 5.13.
Right. Yep. So grub is a little more sophisticated.
So when Lilo tries to load the second stage, if that step fails, is that where Lilo hangs at LI?
Yes. That is correct. And we've all seen that, right?
Yeah.
The LI and yep. Yeah, Lilo had some other assumptions. It assumed that the kernel it was loading was in an EXT2 file system, so it only understands EXT2, and it assumes all the kernels it was loading were Linux kernels. But you say, wait a minute, I booted Windows and I booted BSD. Well, actually, you chain loaded them is what you did, because if with Lilo, if it wasn't a Linux kernel in an EXT2, what it actually did is it reverted back and loaded a second stage boot from a primary partition, and that's called chain loading. So it reverted back into the second stage.
Oh, the one stage two calls another stage two.
Yes.
Right. And then that primary partition then was for whatever kind of system it was. If it was Windows, for instance, then that second stage did whatever it needed to do to load Windows. Now, Grub and System Commander work like Lilo, except they do understand more kinds of file systems and more kinds of OS kernels than Lilo did. Get those again. Stage 2 for the DOS, at least. Remember, this is now running out of a primary partition. So stage two does understand the Windows file system. At least it understands the FAT file system. I don't think it understands. DOS does not understand the Windows H. What is it? HPFS.
NTFS.
Doesn't understand that. But it does understand FAT. And it loads IOSys and MS-DOSSys. Those are the, that's basically the operating system in DOS, mostly as IOSys. This is actually a text file that has configuration information in it. So there is no loader with DOS. You get stage one boot, stage two boot, and then you're running. So it's the simplest thing to boot. The X Works understands FAT12 and FAT16 only. Doesn't even understand FAT32. It loads bootrom.sys. So its second stage has to be on a FAT12 or 16. 12 would be a floppy, 16 would be a hard disk. And it goes in and finds this file name, knows how to read it. It must be at the top level of the disk. It can't be on below. It's got to be at the top level. Finds it, and that bootsys is a loader, so it loads it, and then goes on. Lilo Grub and System Commander and Windows, we talked about, they load as we talked about in before. They're loaded off of their thing. The difference between, these are all living in the track zero, well, mostly, Lilo lives in track zero. Grub partially lives in track zero, as does System Commander lives in track zero. Windows lives in the primary partition at the beginning, starting at sector zero. So it does that same kind of thing, the second stage is one sector, and then it extends itself by reading additional sectors in Windows. So that's where they're the same.
Nowadays, that Windows loader is the NTLDR.
Correct.
Back in Windows 95 days, it was called what?
NTLDR.
It was called NT? LDR, even
right.
In Windows
95,
okay.
Not in Windows 95. In
95 was still
DOS. In 95 was still DOS.
It was still IO.sys?
Yeah, it was still IO.sys in 95. I'm sorry. Windows NT it was called. In Windows NT that came out at the same time, it was called NT-LDR back in NT.
All right, I'm thinking, but I mean, I'm
but
thinking.
Yeah, he's 3, right.
3.1 was really on top of DOS. But you're saying right. That Windows 95, 98, 98 ME used a DOS boot sequence.
Yeah, they were still DOS. Well, 95 was still completely on top of DOS, like 3.1 was. So was 98.
Yeah.
ME was too, but they did a better job of hiding it. It still was.
Well, sometimes, except it crashed a lot more.
They got rid of the boot and command prompt mode in ME, which always moved.
Just to get rid of NT loader.
Yeah. NT loader is the Windows loader, and it works similar to Lilo, in that it only understands, in this case, Windows images. And it only understands Windows file systems. So it understands NTFS. It understands FAT32, FAT16, probably. Still had one. And it understands the Windows kernels. And it gives you, like Lilo, it gives you a choice amongst them. So you can choose which one you want. Grub understands more images. Grub does not understand FreeSB images, though, much to my chagrin, because VXWorks are 3D, or FreeBSD style images. System Commander is the same, except it understands even more. It can load more kinds of images. VXWorks bootsys only understands VXWorks kernel, and it's really ugly because the bootloader provides some of the kernel initialization. The kernel is not a standalone kernel. The the loader actually does some of the initialization of the kernel. That's really ugly.
You said that NT Loader and Grub, they only understand those Windows, only understand Windows images, and yet because the NT Loader gives you the multiple choice, it's capable of throwing control back to a different stage 2 loader on a different partition. Even though
I'm sure that's the way it does it. I didn't check in it, but I'm sure that's the way it's doing it.
Actually, that's what you do. You to make that happen, and you basically copy the bootloader from the partition that you want to boot, and copy that into a file, and then put that in the top-level C directory, and then reference that file in boot.ini. Mm-hmm. So basically, it just transfers to that file, which then loads the system.
Windows Loader isn't designed to do that, but you can trick it into it. You have to take an image of the first or that 512 bytes, the loader for the other operating system, stick it in the back of the file system, and point the anti loader at it. So you can trick it, but it's not meant to do it.
I'm thinking that I could use NT. I haven't done a lot of it in the past, but I thought I had used NT Loader like Lilo as the multiple choice screen as to which partition you want to boot off of.
Yes, you can. You just have to do it the right way.
You have to trick it.
But you have to trick it, okay. I'm not that tricky, so I must have been using somebody else's machine.
You can't point it directly at a partition. You have to point it at a partition and a file to load on that partition on a FAT32 file system or NTFS, something that understands. So yes, but you have to trick it.
Yep.
Same thing with, I guess, when Lilo, and so how does Lilo throw control over to Windows? Like you said,
Lilo simply actually does load sector 1 of the partition.
Right.
But Lilo is designed to do it.
You don't have to trick it.
Yes.
But it's the same concept, but you don't have to trick it.
Yeah. Right. Grub does the same thing, but Grub gives you the ability to go into a command line and boot into it if need be.
Right. Yeah, Grub has some extra capabilities that are in that Grub or that boot directory that you see in your top level of your file system, that boot directory. If you go down in there's some configuration files in there. And in fact, the menu you see, you can modify just by modifying the configuration files down in there.
Yeah, Grub is smart enough that you can actually go into a command line within Grub and then boot it into any partition that you can use.
Okay, so that's actually all there is to the booting. Once you've gotten through the loader, and there's some debate whether the loader is actually the end of the boot or whether it's part of the boot. You know, once you've loaded your operating system, it's done. That's it. We booted it. Any questions on that? If not, there's a couple more topics.
You are going to cover Pixie?
Pixie, yeah. Pixie. Pixie, PXE. PXE stands for pre-execution environment. Weird name, Fart. It's really network booting, called PXE. But it's network booting. It requires a special ROM on the network card, generally. Intel cards, you know, the standard Intel cards, I forgot now what the designation is, something 100P.
Pro
100 and
Pro
1000.
Yeah,
they come with the chip. But Spreecom has some also that have Pixie boot chips on them, but they're ROM chips, and your BIOS has to also have the capability of using the ROM chip, because what the BIOS is going to do is it's going to transfer control to that ROM chip that's on the card. And what that card is going to do is it's going to do either a DHCP or boot P, usually DHCP, broadcast just like any other machine would do to get its information from DHCP about what its address is and all that good stuff that DHCP provides. Plus, and the DHCP server has to be capable of it, plus it's also going to need to get back two more pieces of information. A machine name, actually I believe it gets the address, IP address, and a file name. It's going to use that machine and file name to do a trivial FTP to get its loader. So what you're giving it is the file name of its loader in the trivial FTP directory, which you have to set up on that machine. Now these, technically this, the machine that supplies the TFTP does not need to be the same machine as DHCP. But I had a very nasty experience with a vendor's loader in that it used the TFTP, and that all worked fine. It went to a different machine, loaded the loader, and it says the loader then will load the kernel from the same machine by this name, taking the name and replacing a character 0 by character 1. And it did replace the 0 by the 1, except it went back and tried to do it on the DHCP machine instead of the TFTP machine. And that was a nasty surprise. I couldn't figure out, why is this thing not working? It just dies.
So was that an error in the ROM?
It was an error in the vendor's loader that the TFTP loaded.
Ooh.
That was vendor supplied.
So where did, when the BIOS is looking for bootable devices, it'll determine that the network card is also a bootable device, and then
correct. It's
that
somewhere in that list.
In that list, and you can, or maybe you'll say automatically pick option number 5 or whatever, because
it depends on the BIOS how you do it
to boot off the network.
But it's in the list somewhere.
And you could disallow booting from other things, or make that the first choice, or a bunch of things.
Right.
Way more common with workstations and integrated network cards, though, than adding cards to actually
have a boot. Yeah. Yeah. That gets to the last one. Usually the BIOS is not involved in that boot, but on some of the integrated ones, the BIOS actually, the BIXI is actually stored in the BIOS.
Instead of in the card.
Instead of on the card, yes. And that's really all there is to PIXI. I always thought it was some big magical thing, but it's not.
There's lots of FOC limitations, like the initial file is loaded from TFTP, you can only be up to a meg in size.
It's again real mode.
Which is why you have stuff like EXE Linux, which can then fetch another image. Give you a nice bootloader selection screen.
Right. So your PIXI bootloader here could then conceivably load Grub, for instance.
And from there, anything is possible.
Yeah. Well, you'd really need a modified version of Grub for it to be useful, because remember, the idea of having PIXI boot is to be able to boot on a diskless machine. Mm-hmm. So it has to be able to go off and get it from a remote host somewhere. Not guaranteed. It has to be a diskless machine.
Typically.
Yeah.
How are those network cards designated commonly? And what phraseology is used to identify those? Just say PXE capable or what?
I think you'll always see PXE.
Because
that's how it's coming out.
Yeah, PXE, you'll see it somewhere in the description of the card. Yeah. I think it's in the... Every card has some information that the BIOS can get off the hardware. I think it's generally in that, too. If it's a PIXI-capable boot, there'll be a PXE somewhere in that description that you get from it, I think.
It came out with boot ROMs on the cards, I think, before PXE was started. I think PXE is more of a standardized setup.
As standard as anything I've talked about.
Yeah. As far as standards are concerned.
As far as standards go. Now that brings us to the very last thing, and that is, what else is there? And I wasn't going to talk about this, but I'll talk a little bit about it anyhow. EFI. EFI is Extendable Firmware Interface. It was started back in 2000 by Intel. They called it the Intel Boot Initiative. They transferred it to the Unified EFI Forum, UEFI, and UEFI took it over as a public specification. So it's not a standard, but it's one step below a standard. It's an open specification by a non-vendor, supposedly non-vendor group. The first use of it was for Intel on Itanium. Later, HP used it for Itanium 2. Microsoft uses it for 64-bit Windows, the old one and the new one, and 64-bit, it's used for some Vista and Server 2008 as well. Apple uses it for their Intel-based Macs also. Get back to this in a minute. What is EFI? Well, it's a framework. What is the framework? It's a primitive operating system, a little operating system, a boot manager, and device drivers that live in ROM. So instead of a BIOS, you've got all this stuff in ROM. It is controlled by what they call well-known EFI variables. All those are name value pairs. And the names are predefined. That's why they're called well-known. So there's a predefined set of names in the EFI framework specification. And that's how you control it. You create a configuration file that has these name value pairs in it. It doesn't use the normal boot partition that we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. It uses a thing called a GUID disk partition table. And they did one thing nice. The GUID disk partition table does not live in sector 0 of the disk. Mm-hmm. It does not live where the MBR lives. So you can have an MBR and separate from the GUID. GUID or EFI framework always has a partition on it called the EFI partition, and it is a FAT32. Must be a FAT32 partition. So if you've got an EFI disk, you've got a FAT32 partition. In that FAT32 partition is where the applications, they call them applications, that's where your actual bootloaders and a shell live. And some other stuff can live in there too. But that lives in this disk, in this EFI disk partition, which is always FAT32. And the idea is that the boot manager starts up and it runs an application, and the application it runs is based on what it finds in a variable. Variable says, use this file for the loader. So it goes and does it. And the boot manager can also start up a shell, and you can run interactive to the boot manager. So you can talk to it, change variables, do all kinds of stuff like that. And it all sounds great. And probably was implemented this way on the Itanium. Now, I mentioned it's also used by Apple and it's also used by Vista. The implementations for Apple and Vista and some other later ones are all vendor specific and don't do any of this stuff. Okay? So if somebody else wants to give a nice talk, they can say, well, this is the way Apple does it, and this is the way Vista does it. This is the way XYZ does it. Because Apple and Vista do not do this. Vista does a lot of this architecture, but they don't do it this way. They do it off in their own thing, totally separate. Not sure exactly what Apple does. They do something kind of a hybrid different thing. But that's what EFI is about. Okay, that's it. Any questions? Yeah?
That shell you're talking about there, that's the boot manager's shell for this process?
Correct.
It's strictly relating to that loader?
Strictly relating to this thing here. So what you can do, like what you can do with the shell is, you can look at and change these variables here. You can tell it to boot, for instance, and some other things.
Kind of like the shell that Grub has.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, kind of like that. Yep.
Is EFI based on the open firmware specification, like Apple's open firmware?
No, it's totally different than open firmware.
And actually, I'm guessing that this is just a layer under the open firmware,
yep.
or
open firmware was used and is still used on the PowerPC Macintoshes. This is only used. Apple only uses the EFI on the Intel, not on the PowerPC. PowerPC is still open firmware.
But we still.
The fact that it has a shell. That's about all they have in common.
Yeah, probably. Like I said, I didn't dig into the details of the specifics of the various vendors.
I've got a question I don't really know how to ask.
Okay.
With all this low-level complexity, how do you know that the vendor hasn't done something really nasty like put a parasite in there?
Don't.
So all the stuff that's being manufactured in Red China now or wherever, how do they check that there's... Because recently, in the last 2 months, there was a big thing where they found a bunch of network cards that were shipped in, and every tenth one had a parasite chip on it.
Nasty.
One in ten. Oh.
One in ten. So, and they just happened to stumble on that tenth one and went back and checked this batch of network cards that came in from...
Unless I'm sadly mistaken, you shouldn't touch that chip. At least you shouldn't use that chip. Well, yeah, I guess you would use that chip, wouldn't you?
I don't really remember whether it was network cards or whether it was motherboards that came in from somewhere.
Network cards don't generally have ROM chips on them.
Yeah.
Except unless they've got Pixie chips.
Exactly.
And you won't use the Pixie chips unless you're actually using a Pixie boot.
Yeah, but most servers that you get at least go through the Pixie boot. Until you go into the BIOS and turn that off, it still goes.
That's
that.
True. It comes. You say it comes pre-configured in the list.
Right. And so whatever is in there can run and establish itself in RAM.
These instances of chips were keylogger type things.
Great.
There was something I heard a while back about people finding at least one guy opened up his ThinkPad, you know, once it was Lenovo, and found a chip between the keyboard and the motherboard that looked like it was like a small flash chip and something else on it, and he assumed it was a keyboard. Now, of course, that was just one crazy guy on the internet.
This was something that was...
I can believe it. If you're down in the hardware, you can, you got that BIOS chip on there. You put a lot of stuff in that BIOS chip.
Going back to the power on self-test, back in the old architecture that when you stuck in disk controllers and network cards, that the first BIOS would check and see if there was ROM on those, and then it would execute whatever's in the ROM on each of those extra cards.
That's exactly it, and that's where they use that same signature of A55. It would add each of those ROMs.
Actually,
and it would scan through there and see that, and when it did, it would jump into that routine.
Yeah, video cards still do that.
That's why the first thing you see is a video card message before anything else.
Yeah, most video cards still require visualization. They'll have a chunk of code
in their ROMs that runs to initialize the card, which is why a lot of video cards only work in x86 machines, and you can't throw it in like a PowerPC machine, because that code is an x86
code. And in fact, it's 286 code or less.
Right.
It's real mode code.
Right. Which is why I like the Matrox cards, because they don't have that code. They don't have that. They don't require the machine's machine. Or a few cards that don't.
Yeah, the cards certainly can be built, but they don't need it. Even if they have a complicated initialization, they could do that totally on the card without having the,
exactly.
the processor do
the,
it.
The Matrox cards, I assume, have their own onboard processor.
Right. Well, video cards are so complex now, they almost all have, they have onboard processors anyway.
Right. I mean, they're not general-purpose processors, though. Right. So.
Well, sometimes
they should be able to do initialization, at least. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why the same thing you might put in the adapter SCSI controller. That's what it would do. You jump into that, you know, put it around in the SCSI driver, or
right.
it finish with the bias.
Oh, yeah, that's another thing. What how do they do that SCSI stuff?
Well,
basically, by reading stuff off of the disk. They put drivers on the disk. Read them into memory during the boot cycle.
I thought the RAID controllers had the AA55 on them, so that they, that's why you always get the control C.
I'm going back to the older days when you could buy a SCSI controller, and you got this floppy or CD. You say, oh, you have to load this or you can't use your SCSI. It enables your SCSI. What it's doing is installing drivers, usually in that track zero, so that it can use those during the boot cycle.
So it initialized the card later in the boot cycle. It didn't use code in the ROM. It used a driver that loaded before the operating system
initialized. Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah, because the BIOS didn't know anything about the SCSI. How do you boot from a SCSI? You always had to have an IDE drive or a floppy that it could get first.
Chicken and egg.
Chicken and egg, yeah. Okay.
Marvelous.
That was Rich Seibel, and yes, Rich also gets the coveted yada yada yada.
That's only because I was long-winded.
Yada yada.